You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Welcome back to the final installment of On Boards with Dave Parmenter. Today's episode also includes the voice of Laminator Ryan Martz. Ryan is the son of Greg Martz, which is the founder of the famed Waterman's Guild, which has often been referenced in the preceding three parts of this series. Greg retired a couple of years ago, and Ryan has since taken over the business.
I started working. My dad had me tearing out floors as soon as I was 16, and I could drive up here. I was basically tearing out floors. And then I think once I graduated high school, I started working here part-time, and then within a year I was here full-time. So full-time since 19, part-time since 16.
Did you ever consider not going into the family business?
Yes. But I was doing, I don't know, I was kind of super into surfing at the time. Like, when you're a teenager, like, surfing was absolutely it. And so it seemed like a natural, like, not many people get that opportunity to, like, just go into a shop and be able to do stuff. And I already know the reputation of our shop, so that was kind of cool. And I figured, like, I mean, at the very least, you'd be able to grow upon that, you know, and just learn so much. So I thought, I was super into art. My dad basically said he doesn't have an airbrusher on the premises, so he's like, get in there, learn how to do it. You know, you'll make $120,000 a year doing airbrushing, you know? I'm like, oh, $120,000, I'm in. Quickly found out that was not even close to what you can do, but he got me in here. And then that's basically how it started, so.
Did he simply throw that number out just to entice you in?
I'm like, sure. Where did that number come from? I have no idea where that number was based on, but I mean, no offense to my dad, but he tends to throw some exaggerations out there from time to time. But yeah, no, it was like 100,000, 120,000, something like that. And I'm just like, yeah, absolutely. And then, like, I remember there was like a year, like, I had been airbrushing for a while and I was like pretty good. I was working on like six different shops and I just dedicated like every minute of my life, you know, like worked weekends, everything. And I think I came up with like 55, 60 grand tops, you know, like that. And that's just like working your life away and not enjoying anything that year. So,
yeah, that's funny. You should have had him draft a contract and guarantee that salary.
Right, absolutely. That would have been good.
A part of this episode is actually focused on the economics of board building. So both Ryan and Dave Parmenter will tease apart how the dollars are distributed when you purchase a surfboard. Parmenter and I also get deep into imported surfboards, why board building was ever outsourced from the U.S. in the first place, what the strengths and weaknesses are of that business model, what are the economic, health, and environmental considerations of that method of manufacturing. Dave built SUPs in China for a year, so he's had firsthand experience in factories there. If you haven't listened yet to parts 1 through 3, I'd encourage that you pause this episode, go back and listen to those. They are available for free, as is all past 240 episodes of this show. You can find our entire archives on surfsplendorpodcast.com. We have 5 other shows in production, each with a different focus and format. The whole network is listener-supported with an assist from brands like Neat Essentials, Spy Optic, and Visla. You can support via PayPal donation button on our website. And as a thank you for your support, Channel Islands is donating a surfboard, and any and all donors in the month of October will be entered to win it. One name will be randomly selected from that list of donors, and Channel Islands will gift you a rocket-wide built-in spine tech. The winner will only be responsible for shipping. I've actually been riding the rocket-wide the past couple of weeks in California and absolutely loving it. It's probably classified as a groveler. I'd been riding a fish all summer and was ready to add back a little bit more performance into my surfing. The rocket-wide fills the void kind of between the fish and a high-performance thruster. Again, it's a groveler. So you can get it with various tail shapes. I got mine with a swallow tail. The Spine Tech construction is a 2-pound EPS core, and if you've listened to this series, then you probably know that 2 pounds is a reference to the density. It means that the foam core weighs 2 pounds per cubic foot. The Spine Tech construction is technically stringerless, but it has this composite spine embedded into the deck for about 3/4 length of the surfboard itself. So they route out a little bit of the EPS foam, embed the Spine Tech composite spine, and then they lay up a few strips of carbon cloth on either side to add additional strength. The deck is then glassed with one layer each of warp glass and e-glass. The bottom has a pattern of carbon fiber as well, and then one layer of 4-ounce e-glass. And the board is finished with super sap, epoxy, bioresin. The whole package is meant basically to feel like traditional, familiar PU Flex, but these modern materials are meant to last longer. So not only will the board resist breakage, but it'll retain pop and consistent flex indefinitely, rather than going through the traditional life cycle of a board feeling real lively when you first get it, and then feeling perfect for a period of time before kind of feeling dead and slow. So you can learn more about Spine Tech and the Rocket Wide on surfsplendorpodcast.com/donate. It's also where you can drop a donation in to be entered to win the board. I thank you for that, and thank you to Channel Islands, of course, for the donation of the surfboard. By the way, you can order it to your specs if you win this board, and CI will dial you in with the specific board that fits you best, and then, of course, you will only be responsible for the shipping cost. So thanks for the support, and thanks for all the kind words regarding this series. Parmenter has a real passion for sharing history and also for clarifying misconceptions about both history and board building. So for us, having this platform to share and for you to kind of help spread it virally has been really, really cool. I have plans for more of these multi-part series, one on fins, one on sustainability, more on various aspects of surfboards. So that's where all of your support goes. I know you get that, but just thank you for that. Anyway, in part 3 of this series, we focused on laminating and finishing a surfboard. For clarification, both of those things can simply be referred to as glassing. You shape the foam and then you glass it, but in any scenario, only one person shapes the board. The job of glassing is sometimes broken into multiple specialized roles, with one person laminating, perhaps another hot coating, someone setting fins, someone sanding, someone else polishing. All those will be important to note as we break down the economics of where your money goes when you buy a surfboard. Each of those roles, of course, comes with a salary. So while we covered the glassing process in our last episode, Ryan and I will start our conversation with materials before getting into the environmental and health concerns of glassing, and then, of course, the economics of all of this. My name is David Scales, and this is part 4 of On Boards with Dave Parmenter and special guest Ryan Martz. Enjoy the show. Can you tell me, first of all, what is fiberglass? What's it comprised of? Where does it come from?
Yes and no.
Okay.
I know roughly that, you know, like, I don't know exactly what the strands are. I just kind of know what each cloth kind of has. Like, warp cloth has more vertical strands than horizontal strands. E-cloth is like a 50-50, so it's more pliable. I don't know exactly what it's made of.
Is there a lot of variation in quality between different types of brands? Do you only work with certain brands and not others? Does it matter where in the world that fiberglass comes from? I'm always trying to identify what people are talking about when they talk about a quality surfboard. and how much of that is the materials and how much of it is the technique of, you know, manufacturing. So is there any consideration with brands, or does everybody kind of produce good quality fiberglass at this point?
You know what? As far, I think everything quality wise is, I mean, they're all kind of par, you know, you get what you like. S cloth always tends to be stronger than the regular E's and warps. Volan as well, but it's just, we're more in the cosmetic world here, doing all the high-end longboards with color work and stuff like that. So like a cloth that I might not use, you know, for a certain reason is great on a clear, you know, but like when I add color to it, how it saturates, if it doesn't and leaves like little silvery, you know, in the cloth, or like we have a thing with some of our Volan, we'll like do weird stuff when it's underneath multiple layers. So I mean, our, what we pick is based upon just what gives us the best product, you know, visually and, you know, durability.
Got it. What is Volan?
It's boat builder's cloth back in the day, and before, that's what they first used to lam the polyurethane boards when they first came out. But from everything I know, is it was basically untreated, unbleached, you know, because most boats got gel coated and all that stuff. So it's just a dirtier cloth, tends to be like green when you lam it. And that's just basically it. And then once, you know, the whole polyester surfboard manufacturing went, then they started designing cloth specifically for that. And that's when we got into what we have now.
So why do people still use Volan?
A lot of stuff is just for the classic, I think. I mean, also the Volans come in a lot heavier cloths too. So the people that want the heavier cloths are, you know, more, they want that retro feel and everything. So why not have the exact thing that they used back in the day? So that's my guess.
It's more of a throwback thing.
Yeah, I would think so.
What is resin? What is it comprised of? Where does it come from?
Our resin, we use Silmar. And I know they're a company here in the United States. What it is exactly, again, I have no idea.
How many different types of resin are there, or do you use here?
We currently use three different types of resin and then epoxy on top of that. But polyester resin, we have the lam resin and hot coat resin, gloss resin, and we have two different kinds of lam resin. So, I mean, technically four. And then epoxy separate from that.
Why do you have two different types of lam resin?
Just for the color. For clear boards, they put an optical brightener in it, and then it's not necessary for, because we're adding pigments and everything to the color board, so not necessary.
What does the optical brightener do?
Just gives it a whiter. The plain tends to have a more of a greenish, and then that goes hand in hand with Volans. So when you have that old school greener resin with the greener cloth, that gives that classic green Volan feel. So the optical brightener is for more modern shortboard and just anything that's clear. It just has a whiter look when it's on the board.
Got it. What are the pros and cons of polyester resin versus epoxy resin?
I don't know where to begin. There's a lot. I mean, there's a lot. I don't like working with, and I'll tell you that. The epoxy resin, I did it here for about 10 years. I just kind of stepped away and brought another guy in to kind of do it. It's good. I like epoxy boards. It's just, it's a lot more problematic to work with. It tends to be very sensitive to any kind of environmental change. Tons of things that could go wrong with it. It is very strong. So, I mean, it's just, it's a catch-22. It's like, it works really well for longevity, but it's a nightmare to work with. I just, from a board builder, not fun to work with unless that's all you do. If you have to jump back and forth between stuff, it's kind of a nightmare.
In what ways is it difficult to work with?
It's extra sticky.
Okay.
Extra sticky, takes forever to cure, you know, unless you have like a perfect, you know, room temperature, a heater or anything.
Controlled environment.
Thank you. Yeah. That's the word. When you sand it, it's, I don't know what it is about sanding epoxy fiberglass combo, it's the itchiest thing in the world. Hmm. It gets everywhere. So
the dust itself.
The dust itself is just, it's awful. So like come in the summertime, you have to be in a full like hooded sweatshirt, you know, with pant, like you just don't want it on you at all because it's awful. If you like don't clean well enough and you put on a jacket, like your jacket will be itchy for, you might as well throw that thing away.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a problem. Perfect segue actually to what are the main health concerns for working in this environment?
I don't know how to answer that. It's not ideal. It's a dirty job. It's dusty. It's fumey, but I mean, all the older generation is pretty much still around and kicking. Yeah, I've yet to see anyone go down due to cancer that I know of personally, except for skin cancer, and that goes hand in hand with what we do outside of here. So
sure. So the two concerns are what you're ingesting maybe into your lungs, and the second would be what your skin's exposed to?
Yeah, I would think. Okay. Yeah.
And what are the ways to mitigate against those? And can you fully mitigate against those?
I wear a respirator whenever I lamb or do as much as I can. If I'm grinding, doing anything with dust, I highly recommend wearing a respirator and wearing whatever you can, protective like Tyvek pants or suits. That being said, you still get a lot on you. And it's I haven't noticed anything. And like I said, everyone's still ticking, but it's not ideal.
So the respirator, does that provide 100% safety?
I like to think it does. I don't know.
Okay. I mean, I'm just comparing it to what you just said about covering up your skin, where some stuff still always gets through no matter how well you cover. With the respirator, we don't know.
I don't know. I'm sure I could look, but it's one of those things. Like I said, I've never done anything else, and this is where I am. I'm pretty deep now, so it's like, yeah, I'd like to not know.
I mean, you even hear about bakers getting, you know, baker's lung or whatever from just inhaling flour. Mm-hmm. So there's not a lot of environments that are 100% safe.
Right.
But I feel like because we're at least aware of the health concerns in the surf industry, we do try to mitigate against it, where other industries I don't think they do. Like gardeners probably inhale more airborne particulate than you do.
Yeah. And like I said, we have proper ventilation systems and everything, like so it's not, if you're wearing, you know, all your protective gear and then you just go outside, you should be fine. And generally, like, we lamb boards when they're done, we walk outside, go take a break, go take a breather. By then, I've found that like fumes are always the worst when the thing's actually going off. Like, you might come in here and it smells like resin, but what actually affects you is when it's still in the liquid form, turning into the hard form. That is when you'll get the effects of, you know, the lightheadedness, the dizziness, watery eyes, all that stuff. So yeah, I mean, when we're working with it, it's mask, be protected, and then, you know, we'll walk out, and once it kicks, it's really not that bad.
What are the main environmental concerns, either working in this environment or that are generated from this environment?
Not ideal. These are tough questions. I mean, we know we're not making wonderful things here, you know.
Well, but I think it's important to illuminate it, because everybody just says, like, oh, the surfboard manufacturing is dirty. And then these other entities come along and talk about, quote, sustainability. Mm-hmm. I've never seen any longitudinal studies. I'm not convinced about any of the sustainability conversation.
Yeah.
I don't know that anybody's ever done a really comprehensive study on any of that stuff.
Right.
So I'm really curious about what are the legitimate concerns. We're aware, I mean, Parmenter said in this series that we're doing, he's like, look, you can't talk about sustainability. You can talk about conservation. Mm-hmm. We already know that we're doing something that is creating damage. We've accepted that. We know that we want to surf, so we're going to create surfboards. So now let's do it in the most responsible fashion. And so now we're talking about conservation rather than, you know, sustainability.
Yeah, I would agree.
What are the concerns? What Is there airborne concerns? Are there things going into the atmosphere that way? Or is it all strictly waste that goes out?
The more that I gathered from dealing with the EPA is more the waste that goes out.
Okay.
And the real problem tends to be anything that's liquidy or gel or goo. Once it's off and it's rock hard, like candy and stuff, they said it's really, there's nothing to it, you know. It goes into a landfill and slowly goes through the whole process and goes back into, you know, what it does. Sorry, I don't know all the scientific terms for it.
No, but that makes sense.
But the big things are the liquids, because how they get absorbed in the soil or go in drains or into the ocean or anything like that. But once it's hard, it's pretty much off and not really toxic.
And so do they mandate that nothing can leave the factory in liquid form, or how do they handle that?
Yeah, I mean, that's ideally, that's what it is. We do everything here that we can do to combat that. That is a side note for a lot of the smaller factories. I can't speak on the behalf of all builders. Here we definitely do everything that we can do. We put all our hazardous waste, goes into a drum that gets picked up multiple times a year, goes to a facility where they do everything up to code. We pay, it all goes back to the EPA. We have an acetone recycler here, which a lot of shops don't have. That's huge, because I know I've worked at shops, I'm not going to name names or anything, but I've worked at shops where I know they would just pour foam dust in the old acetone and just let it get jelly hard, and or not fully off, but just not full liquid, and throw it away and do stuff like that. Whereas, like, we absolutely we have the recycler, so we get probably, I'd say, 75-80% of our old dirty tone back, and everything else just gets turned into that rock hard candy, which, you know, we put into and we still put that into our hazardous waste bin and have that taken care of, even though technically when it's rock hard it should be fine to go into the landfill.
Are those things mandated by the EPA, or are those just self-imposed kind of regulation?
Both. I mean the EPA definitely wants you to, like, they don't require that you have an acetone recycler or anything, but that's just, it's good for us. Like I said, we know we're not, you know, helping the situation, but we want to be as good as we can to, you know, not just openly abuse, you know.
I would imagine both the acetone recycling and the hazardous waste disposal is an added expense probably for the business.
The recycling tends to work out. It's a big initial investment.
Okay.
And then like we actually get 75% back, so in the long run it actually helps.
Okay.
But the hazardous waste is definitely a cost.
Okay. Parmenter mentioned that regulations in California are so tight that the days of kind of running a glass shop under the radar and off the radar of authorities are over. Like back in the, you know, certainly the 70s, but even 80s, 90s, there was a lot of small glass shops operating that nobody even knew about, or the regulators didn't know about. I was surprised to hear him say that those days are over. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't think they're over.
They're not over. They're
definitely not over.
So you're running, you're obviously built to code. Mm. The city and the officials know that you're here. The EPA knows you're here, and you're doing things to code.
Yes.
There are factories that aren't doing
it to code. Yes, there are factories that aren't.
Because we talk about California being the, I don't know, on the cutting edge of board building, or certainly like producing quality surfboards that are known around the world and respected. That's not to say that they're all produced to the same quality.
Right.
Is kind of what I'm curious about.
Yeah, it would definitely be harder to open up a big name shop and just come out and do it. And I think, but there are a lot of shops that are still around that have still been built, and they might have gone under, but they sold to somebody else, and the facility itself is not up to code. And if you don't register the name, no one's coming to look.
Right.
So, if you're, I mean, that's another thing, is just having a business license, I mean, we're subject to, you know, shakedowns by the city, you know, for whatever they want to hit us for. They want to charge us tax on everything that we buy for the factory that has nothing to do, we already pay tax on. But yeah, I was talking to the fire department when they came by, and I just asked, because I know of other buildings, or just how do they come by our place? Do they just walk down the whole block and go door to door, or did they go down a list of, you know, registered businesses? And they go down a list of registered business. So you don't register your business, they're not going to come,
right?
Unless you catch something on fire or someone reports you.
But. Sure. Interesting. Another reason why I'm asking all this is just because that's all added expense, right?
Right.
It's all added expense for your business.
Absolutely.
And consumers then, of course, pay more for it.
Yes.
For the product. Final question is just, I wanted to, if you're comfortable doing it, to outline pricing. Let's just say that a board costs $800 on the retail rack. What is the blank cost and profit margin for the shaper? What are the materials costs and profit for the glasser? Is there an industry standard kind of fair wage to pay a laminator per board, a sander, a polisher?
I feel like we're not fully in that conversation. Like, everyone's so varied across, and it depends on what you're doing, whether you're doing high performance short boards or you're doing high end, you know, color boards. It's kind of all over the map. And a lot of people also get more for shapers. It varies drastically because however long they've been doing it, if they're overhead, you know, whether they're worth people wanting to pay the extra for it. And I feel everyone's worth, we don't make enough in this industry, you know, for what we do. So good on the people that, you know, charge and get it. So
is there a range that we can at least give listeners for a shaper? How much can a shaper, what is the range that a shaper might get paid on the low end per board, all the way up to whatever, Skip Fry?
I would say a low end shaper would get as low as $50
per shape.
Per shape, I'd say low $50. I'd say high can be anywhere, you know, John Peck's and guys like that get up to $1,000 or $600 a shape.
Yeah. What would be, let's give a range for what a laminator would get paid. And is that, are they paid per board, or how does that work?
Yeah, this industry, as far as I know, is mostly piecework, so gotcha. Everything gets per item or per board. To lam a clear short board, you're anywhere from like 17, 18 to, if you're working somewhere great, a little over $20.
Okay.
And then
per board, and how long does it take somebody to do a board?
It all depends.
Can they do it in 1 hour?
Yeah, they could. So or could, but it, like, people in the beginning, like when you first start out, it's, you definitely, I mean, at least here we were learning, you know, trying to be good before you got your numbers. And that's with any stage in here, there's going to be a learning curve. It's going to take a little while. And so, yeah, you definitely don't make as much until, you know, you have some time and some boards under your belt. And that all comes with just time.
Right. What about sander? Board price range?
Same thing. I mean, it can go from, I'd say, I'm sure there's people paying nothing. I don't know the extra low stuff. I make sure we pay our guys really well here. I've kind of gone around the industry, and I know we're at the top of paying people.
Yeah.
But I would say 15 is low. 20 would be kind of average for a sand-only shortboard, and then everything just kind of goes up from there.
So that $800 shortboard that's on the rack, you're giving the shaper $50 on the low end, maybe $100, $150 kind of for an average price. Mm-hmm. Laminator's making $20. Sander's making $20. What are the roles and prices other than the materials cost?
Hot coder's making another, you know, roughly $10 to $15. You got the fin guy installing boxes at anywhere from $1 to $3 per box. You're paying for the boxes to go in. If the board is being glossed, then you're glossing it, and then you're sanding and polishing it as well. That's an extra cost.
So you're looking at maybe $200 to $300 in labor costs alone.
Yeah. would say.
Yeah, not factoring in, of course, material costs and overhead for running the business.
And that's the other one is the overhead. That's the huge one that no one takes into consideration, I would say.
And I would say that actually fluctuates maybe the most as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, as much as those other things fluctuate, you know, if you are up to code.
Yeah.
And depending on what city you're doing it in.
Yeah. I mean, everything kind of comes back to the shaper. Ultimately, it's if the guy is doing it in his garage and is happy with the level amount of boards that he's doing out of his garage, then great, he can charge a lot less. But if he has to go have a retail space and a showroom to do all his stuff, then his stuff's going to cost more. And that's just the way it goes. And if you start getting into computer cuts, then you're paying more. And if you're hiring guys to outsource, like the piece of the pie just keeps getting smaller and smaller. So it's all just depends on, you know, who you're buying your board from.
Right. Thank you, Ryan. His glass shop is in Santa Ana, California. It's the Waterman's Guild, founded in 1983 by Ryan's father, Greg Martz. Among their current list of clients are Almond Surfboards, Ryan Lovelace, Night Train, Gato Heroi, and of course, Aleutian Juice, which is Dave Parmenter's label. And here's Dave with more on pricing.
Yeah, you buy a blank for $60, and then based on each shaper would probably pay himself a certain amount of money to...
What's the fair rate?
It varies so much. I mean, you get a guy like Skip Fry that costs, like, you know... Like,
no, but we're talking 6.0 shortboard on the rack.
Okay, for a $700 board.
Yes.
So if it's somebody that is... owns the label himself and isn't just getting paid, you're probably getting lucky to pay yourself $100 to shape the board. And
$60 for the blank, $100 for labor for the shaper.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then there's sandpaper, logos, all the other stuff that you have to pay.
Some materials costs.
Rent for your thing, government stuff, respirators, all that stuff that that all has to be factored in. I mean, you probably, it's like $1, $1.50 a board just for lambs, for the rice papers you put on there. But the glassers really have to bear the weight in this, because I can just go buy a blank and I can make a customer a board. All my needs and tools and everything are fairly static. They're just there. I don't need to buy. They have to have resins, cloths, all the hardeners, pigments, they have to have FCS stuff, they have to have future fin stuff, and they have to have it or they're going to lose a sale or boards are going to just get stuck in irons.
A lot and more raw material.
And so they're lucky, maybe they're getting net 15 or something like that. And then they're dealing with surf shops maybe that don't pay them right away.
Right.
Which is kind of standard in the industry. They're notorious for just, oh, I'll get net 180, you know, or something like that.
Right.
Yeah. So they have to get all these materials. I don't. I just have to get a blank. So they're the ones that are in the real crunch. So if you go to a contract glass shop after that, so let's say $175 or even $200 for a blank and a shape and all the overhead on the shaper side, and then you go to a glasser and you're going to get a clear sanded hot coat, removable fin system without the fins included, you're going to be paying anywhere from $180 to $200 plus for that, with no extras or anything.
So you're up to $400.
Yeah. And from there, there's that's just like the bare bones.
Right.
So then if you own the label, then like if you paid yourself to shape the board, that's that. But then there's profit too. Like you're not just, you double dip or anything like that. So
the board, let's $400
and
bucks, let's
say. And that's
say.
Efficient. No, the bigger you get. Yeah. That's a garage or backyard thing. The bigger you get, the more, then you have to pay for advertising. You have to have, you know,
all the accounting
comp,
involved,
everything. It's like, it just goes up. So
taxes.
when you see, and then there's the markup too. And I think most surf shops, it's been a while since I've been involved in that thing, but I think most surf shops would be pretty happy to make like, you know, $50 to $75 markup on a board.
Okay.
It used to be, and it might have changed now because there's more of an implied value in surfboards because they look so nice now and everybody, you know, everybody's a surfer. But they used to be kind of looked at for a lot of surf shops, at least in this modern era when there's so much markup on apparel and stuff like that, as loss leaders or a prestige item.
Right.
Just that you had it because, hey, I'm a surf shop here. You know, I'm not making any money on these boards, but they're here and they're getting you in here to buy wax and leashes and stuff like that.
So $400, let's say, in raw materials cost and overhead between the shaper and the glasser, retailing for $700, so that $300 kind of delta is divided up between those three parties in terms of profit.
I would think that that would only exist for somebody that's doing it on a shoestring. I don't think that would, those margins would not exist for...
But even those margins aren't, they're not gaudy. I mean, those are slim margins as is, you know?
Well, then there's, then, okay, being in the surfboard trade, whether you're glassing or you're shapers, especially if you're a glasser, is, it's all about crisis management. It's all about damage control. There's not a day that doesn't go by that something doesn't just come unhinged. You know, it's entropy. You know, things fall apart. The center cannot hold. And those things eat you a lot, too. Things like having to redo something.
Absolutely,
or, and
yeah.
Transportation, getting, you know, just people that wanted a board by a surf trip and it doesn't get done because the glasser's cousin's uncle's brother got bit by a dog and had to go bail it out. You know, I mean, there's just all these things, surfer labor. And like you said, there's not much of a cushion. But I think that there's... Gordon Clark always said that the guys that did really well, you know, financially in surfboards are very small and efficient, or the very big guys. I think the guys in the middle are the ones that are always struggling.
And that seems to be the case today.
Yeah.
In, I mean, this probably fits under the heading of the economics as well. We were going to talk about... China manufactured boards and the definition of pop out boards.
Yeah, that's
and all
a
that
great
sort of
that's a great point, because that's kind of a thing where you want to like kind of compare and contrast all these different types of composite structures, because people say pop out,
right?
And under that term, there's this huge gamut of surf craft, and the thing is, there's no such thing as a pop out really. There's
so I've understood pop out to mean from my youth, people started using it. It was always a pejorative.
Yeah.
It was a negative. And it was meant to refer to something that wasn't hand shaped, essentially. It was like, oh, that board didn't come from a shaper down the street whose label, you know, whose name I know and is on the label. It came from usually Asia, mass produced. Without, like, there's no customization. That's the pop-out component, is no customization.
That's an over... That, but what's funny is that's kind of an oversimplification. Oversimplification. Okay. So
what is the definition?
Well, there really isn't anything... The only thing that's really a pop-out in this is... which means like something that just popped out of a mold and ready to go. That doesn't exist. Blanks are pop-outs. Our blanks are pop-outs.
Right.
There were some boards... Like there were... I remember you were talking with Greg Martz on one of the shows where you're talking about these kits... the surfboard kits that used to exist in the 60s, 70s. Well, one of the ones that he didn't mention was Dave Sweet had these. They had all these different kits that you could buy. And, or there was even types of surf longboards that were, they called pop-outs that weren't really even pop-outs. They were just mass-produced boards. They were just kind of done assembly line. And then there was some, remember this one that was called a Huntington Hawaii, and it had a, like a plastic skin that had an injection molded EPS into it, so there's really no bond. It was just the pressure of whatever was expanding inside this thing.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was. I remember I cut it apart and I shaped another board out of it.
Wow.
But I wouldn't even call that it's like an injection molded thing. Would you call that a pop out? So, so what's going on now is we have a vastly different, huge array of when people say pop out. When people say pop out, they're referring to boards from like Asia or China or something like that. I don't really see that exists. So we have to kind of discriminate between the type of molded composite boards that we see coming from like Cobra, which makes SurfTech boards.
What is Cobra?
Cobra is a factory in Thailand that they did, I think, like 90% of the world's sailboard and wakeboard things before the surfing thing hit them. And they had mastered this whole construction process that, and actually Randy French, who was the founder of SurfTech, was working on these types of boards when he was up in the Pacific Northwest doing sailboards. And he was doing some of these boards for Rusty and some other top shapers back in the late 80s, I believe, or early 90s, the same construction, where you have a lightweight, like EPS core with a very thin, 1/8 inch thick sheet of 9-pound density Divinisil that is wrapped around that core with layers of glass and resin and molded under heat and pressure.
What is Definicel?
Definicel is it's a type of high density foam. It's a,
okay.
Yeah.
Is it a polyurethane foam?
No, I believe it is a. It's in the polyester family, I believe. Clark Foam used to sell high density foams, and they use it in marine applications. They used to make fins out of it.
It's malleable.
In an eighth inch sheet, it is.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's a super thin skin. So the way that those boards are built is they have, like, say, a clamshell mold of a given model. They have a EPS shape that is a replica of the master, whatever master shaper made that blank. It is machine shaped, and the tolerances don't have to be perfect because 1 pound EPS is very compressible. So in a mold, it almost pays to have it maybe a little more oversized because you're going to get a better bond with the parts. So, and they have their own proprietary thing. I probably don't want to get into it too much, but what their boards are is a sandwich of that super lightweight core with a layer of fiberglass and resin with the 1/8 inch Definicel wrapped entirely around it, like in this super hard, you know, like monocoque fuselage, and then another layer of glass, and then they have their fill coat, and then they have some sort of acrylic like spray that, you know, gives them that look, right? Those boards, when they're made like that, there's like 40 or 50 man hours in that, which is probably more than our surfboards here, you know, in that. So it's a very complex thing, and it's a very good way to build surfboards for large framework surfboards or paddleboards, sailboards, where you have a larger core to skin ratio. So this is an interesting thing about surfboards or sailboards, is that the more volume that the board has, the bigger it is, they start to get lighter. Because at some point, like if you take a 6.0 kind of like Kelly Slater pro level board, and then you take an 11 foot stand-up board or something that's 28 inches wide and almost 5 inches thick, there's a greater ratio of that lightweight core to the skin, to that skin where all the weight is. So
it's not for twice as much volume, it's not two times heavier.
No, exactly.
It's probably three times the volume, actually.
Yeah. And so they actually can get lighter. So I've always felt that type of construction is a really good way to build those, you know, large cord or that really big oversized surfboard. As a matter of opinion, I don't like how shortboards feel like that. Longboards a little bit better. Some longboards built like that are pretty good because they have a different feel and they're very strong. So now
there's less customization in that model though.
Of course,
too,
that's
right?
The problem. There's less customization. So I'm not giving you my opinion of the boards. I'm just telling you how they're made and that we can't tar them with the same brush. Because these boards are very complex structures, they're made very well. The reason that they're overseas is not because of the expertise or because they have something we can't do there. We have the expertise, we have that ability to do it here. It's done because it's cheaper to build them there. And in a lot of those countries, they don't have the regulations, they don't have OSHA, they don't have the EPA. Hell, we don't have EPA anymore. But that's the reason why it's there, you know. Now, I've been to China. I've seen it. Getting involved with the stand-up thing, which we pioneered with C4 Waterman, for a long time, I tried to build the boards in Hawaii. I didn't want to go overseas, but to withhold that from my partners, and we were already overrun by people that were going to do it anyway. No one would build the boards for us in Hawaii. No one wanted to know about it. And this is back in pretty early on in the game, right? Like, we started doing it in 2002. Formed C4 Waterman in 2006, and it wasn't until a couple years later that everybody jumped on the bandwagon. But that gave me a chance to go to China and see how a lot of the other types of boards are built. So you have that SurfTech Cobra kind of construction, which I think is the gold standard of that molded composite construction, where they're, because the key thing in that is that fuselage of high density foam that is around the EPS core. Now, a lot of the other boards you see, there's this buzzword, epoxy. Oh, I want an epoxy board. You go to the big box stores here and you see an epoxy stand-up board or something like that. That's not made that way. Usually what happens over there is that they just take regular 1 pound EPS foam and they have all these guys that are just shaping, looking at a master. A lot of times it's not even done on a CNC machine. And I mean, I've seen these guys work hard. There's guys over there don't know anything about surfing, don't know what these things are for. And they're in there just power shaping with the wrong tools on crappy stands and poorly lit bays, these boards over and over and over, and then they're hand glassed with just regular fiberglass yarn and epoxy resin. And the problem with those is it's hard to get them watertight anywhere. When you do boards like that, they there's a lot of things that when you build boards like that without that intervening layer of that kind of fuselage around it of the high density foam, they tend to want to be vacuum bagged or anything, but because there's so much air volume and it's so light inside that when epoxy or any resin starts to go off, it kind of exotherms or it heats up and it starts to draw air out of the core, and so you get pin air. So a lot of people will go to a big box store and go, oh wow, a stand-up epoxy stand-up board. Epoxy is a brand name, right, to them. They don't know it's just the resin,
right?
And it's like, wow, $600 for the paddle. They get it, and then they don't realize that they get it in the water and they get it in the sun and it starts sucking in water. So, and are those pop-outs? No, somebody had to hand shape it. Somebody had to hand, it's just done in a place where labor's cheap and people just take the stuff and dump it out in the field. I mean, it's incredible. It's Dickensian when you look at how things are built in places like some of those countries. And so there are no real pop-outs. Even if you go and you see a nice looking polyurethane, polyester, someone bought a brand name or something, those are still largely hand-shaped, hand-laid up boards. Even if the foam is shaped on a machine and finished, on a CNC and finished, none of this is automated. There's still people over there. The rub in this is that you're relying on cheap labor with no, they have no safety net.
Right. So you referenced vacuum bagging. What is vacuum bagging and where does that apply in this equation?
Well, vacuum bagging in this, I think they would do on some of these better constructions that we're talking about with the molded composites, is they do an end run around the vacuum bagging by having these molds, like these two-part clamshell molds that go and they seal everything together. And vacuum bagging does a big thing. You put a polyethylene bag that's, you know, made for this thing around a board with pre-laid out parts like your glass and resin, it's pre-impregnated and everything's laid up, and then
the resin catalyzed and
everything's ready to go. You do it,
wet
it all out, and then it's
wrap the
then
bag.
You have a vacuum that has a these different regulators and different things that get excess resin or air out of there, and you just suck it all together. And so what's good about vacuum bagging is it gives a really good bond because you get a real good adherence of that adhesive or the resin and the glass to the foam, and it gets rid of excess resin, so you have a really light board. And so when you go to the next phases, you get rid of a lot of extra weight. It's hard to do. Not everybody does it. It would be nice if everybody could do one in their backyard, but it's definitely a skill.
Is there a downside?
No, I don't think so, other than the fact that you're using epoxy. I mean, usually, because most people would be doing that with EPSs and things like that.
Why can't you do it with poly?
You could, but why would you? The polyurethane foam's already so strong, it doesn't really need, you wouldn't really need that. You're usually doing it to do more complex structures, or you're doing EPS and epoxy, and or sometimes you're doing it with veneers if you're going to put a bamboo or something like that. But most polyurethane boards are already ahead of the game, just using a good quality resin and a good glass schedule. Like, it's kind of like gilding the lily. I mean, you could, and it would help. But once again, most surfboards are made because they're cheap and easy to make. And one of the things, like I said earlier, is that, Gordon Clark always said, no matter what, materials and everything like that, says shape and design trump everything. He said, all things being equal, a better designed and better shaped board is going to work better, regardless. So I think one of the reasons why I like polyurethane foam and the current culture of how we build them is with polyester resins is that I'm more of a designer, and I like to change the design and make boards that work better. And I like to do it from board to board, not only for myself, but for my customers and clients.
Right.
And it's when you have a system like that that's really easy to do, and you have a foam company like US Blanks, that it's really easy to get custom blanks with custom rockers readily available with high quality and everything. I just find that I'm easier to keep up on those design cycles. So that gets us to the point of, so what are the downsides of these molded composite companies that make these molded boards, like Surftech? The thing is you start to get into like the the big three Detroit automakers where they enforce their model years. So for me, it's a, as a backyard shaper, it is a benefit and an advantage to change the design overnight. And I can do it immediately. I can do it. I can change it. I can change glassing stuff with Greg Martz and Waterman's Guild, all my glass. I can change that immediately to react to design changes.
Right.
Those companies, once they get a master plug, a design, they have to market it. They pay the shaper royalties. It goes into production. They have a mold for it. It's not in their interest to really change it. Now, for stand-up boards or long boards that don't really change as fast as short boards, that's one thing. But yeah. But so what I always worry is it's a danger when there's an obstruction to design innovation like right. that.
And to be honest, we've seen with a lot of those companies, what the team riders are riding on tour or elsewhere are poly models that are made just like the boards that you're making. And then they're refining that
yeah.
to then go make the mass produced.
True, but it still costs them money to retool. So that, I mean, that's a good
point.
They're riding those boards.
But I think that's it's actually a kind of a bait and switch in a sense, because what the consumer is watching their favorite team rider ride in a contest isn't necessarily, that might be what's on available on the market a year from now, but that's not what they go to the shop tomorrow and buy.
No, and it'll, in one way that, like, people are always talking about the you know, I remember, you know, Greg Knoll always asking me like what I thought about it, and I should, you know, write something about it and do something about that whole molded thing. And this is like 20 years ago. But I just said, no, it's the easy thing. Like, even with C4 Waterman, when we had people coming in and copying what we were doing or beating us to market because they had a better distribution and business model or something, I just said, we'll just out innovate them. I'll just come up with something new that will make everything they have obsolete. And that's the best way to do it. And I still believe that. I still think the best thing, the best competition or the best way to obstruct a real or perceived threat by this type of board manufacturer is to just innovate. Make their boards obsolete. Make that whole, all those warehouses full of short boards or long boards obsolete with better design.
Yeah.
And if I can't do it in a way that's recognized around the world, at least I can just do it for my customers.
Right,
you know?
Right. What are the reasons that people are doing veneers on boards and vacuum bagging them in? Is it a strength thing? Is it strictly an aesthetic thing? Is it a performance thing?
Well, it's both. It's in all. We used a lot of bamboo veneers on our molded composite stand-up boards at C4 Waterman, and it was a cheaper and more natural alternative to carbon fiber.
Oh, okay.
And one of the things that we would tell people or that's said around the industry is that bamboo is nature's, you know, carbon fiber, and it's renewable,
right?
And it does look good. It's easy to work with, non-toxic.
Okay,
but it does the same thing. It just adds to or reinforces the basic skin of a surfboard.
I guess as you're saying it, I have seen it as an entire veneer over a board, but mm-hmm. we see carbon used in strips to strengthen the tail and things like that. Is bamboo used in the same way? Just in strips?
It probably could be. In the type of boards that we're talking about where, like, you know, Surfer Joe goes down and orders a board or buys a board at a shop for ordinary surfing, you're probably not going to see it as much.
I can't think of having seen it.
But when you start getting into these constructions that use, you know, molds under heat or pressure or use vacuum bagging, then it becomes more viable.
Okay.
But... you know, the thing about I just want to emphasize why these boards, like, I am a proponent of how these boards are built, some of the better ones. The ones we're talking about, like, with the high density foam and everything's really, I mean, that's the gold standard like that. There's a lot of other ones that just kind of ride the coattails of the buzzword of epoxy. And I just want to make it clear that there's no such thing as an epoxy surfboard. Epoxy is just the resin. And of that, there's many different types of resin. And then there's what cloth you're using, what kinds of cores. I mean, you've got polyurethane, you've got polystyrenes, which people sometimes say styrofoam. Styrofoam is really not, styrofoam is a trade name for a type of polystyrene, and it's an extruded polystyrene. It's kind of what you see with it, clamshell containers for food and things like that. It's like Kleenex, it's a trade name. It's not a type of foam for our uses. EPS is expanded polystyrene. It's that bead foam that we see in different, and in those applications, there's many different types of foams. There's just some garden variety beaded foam that you would use for cutting, you know, with a hot wire coolers and things like that. And then there's formulations that have the beads are more fused together, which is good for surfing. You know, the beads are tighter together. And then there's some types of EPS that are compression molded in molds, just like, you know, regular polyurethane foam. You know, US Blanks does it, Marco, people like that. And those are fantastic blanks. You know, they're the best of both worlds.
So in the hot wire cutting situation, you have a giant block of foam basically and a hot wire that cuts it into the blank size that you
want. Yeah, and there's templates for it that they follow.
But that big block was also just molded together, right? It's in probably
it's
just
a bunch
a larger
of, it's
mold?
A bunch of those polystyrene pellets that are smelted together, and they're blown with different gases. Some of them are innocuous. Some of them, I don't know. I've had some weird headaches from them.
Oh, really?
in an enclosed shaping room. But
so the molded or the fused EPS that you're talking about is also a molded. It's just a much smaller area that they're molding
the,
it in,
like a 6 foot compression tube. Molded ones. That, right. That's just they're blown just like regular polyurethane blanks. They're just using a different material.
So it's a tighter cell structure than the larger block.
And they finish. Yeah, they're way tighter, and they come in blanks that are just not. They're not just raw, you know, slab cut like you see a lot of foams. They're not just cut with a hot wire. They're molded for a particular blank, and they can the rockers can be altered. Uh-oh. And they also they tool and finish a lot better than a lot of the bead foams, the more garden variety bead foams, to the point where you don't even need to spackle them. A lot of EPSs are you usually have to go in there and do some sort of a slurry of epoxy resin and micro balloons or some sort of lightweight spackling like you'd use for your wall just to fill in all the voids. And so it's a process there,
right.
Too. Yeah.
So but the fused EPS or the tighter fused EPS finishes more similarly to polyurethane.
Well, relative to, I mean, it doesn't finish quite as creamy and nice. It's not that, you know, the Cadillac of foams, like I was saying, the polyurethane is, but it is
tighter cell structure.
It's way tighter, and it can be dealt with, and it can be screened and sanded and glassed. Like I said, cosmetically, it'll finish a lot closer to a polyurethane blank.
And those things can be the same density, the block cut EPS and the fused EPS. It's just tighter cell structure.
Yeah, they'll have, you know, 1.5 pound, and then they'll have, you know, like a 2.1 or something like that. But yeah, the compression molded one's always just going to be, I mean, the weight's going to be there, but it's still going to be a better foam.
Just the cell structure is the only difference, essentially.
Yeah, it's a lot better, and it's probably harder for the air to communicate through the entire structure too.
Yeah.
You know, if it gets open or if it sucks in water.
So we were talking about Asian manufactured surfboards. Let's talk about the economics of that, or why surfboard manufacturing was ever outsourced in the first place.
Well, it was outsourced because of the things just get too expensive to make here. Workmanship gets expensive, and like in California example, like with Clark Foam shutting down, it's not a very business-friendly state. We started getting all these environmental regulations and things with fire codes and things with manufacturing, things with chemicals, and, you know, all to the good. But what's sorry about this is that we've dumped it on other people. We've dumped it in places where there are no regulations. We don't know where the raw materials are. Where's the resin and foams coming from? And I when I was there, I would see foam tailings. They just take it and dump it in the field. They don't have...
Yeah.
You know, like medical stations at these places to if someone gets in an industrial accident or gets chemicals in their eyes or something, it's there because it's cheap and there's no regulations.
So that's a good point. We talked off air about not wanting to vilify something just because it's made in a different country. And I was having a conversation with a friend recently who was like, you know, if those boards in Asia are manufactured by, let's say, unskilled laborers, and in the example, he was actually referencing a specific example of an image that he saw, a photograph that he saw of a factory there, and it was a bunch of Thai women manufacturing surfboards, right? And there's a lot of turnover in that factory, so they're not skilled laborers. They've been there for 3 months or whatever, and in 3 months from now, there might be somebody else. And his argument was, well, I don't feel like you know, the Californian middle-aged white guy deserves a job any more than that Thai woman deserves a job. They're both just humans, and they both deserve to work if they're willing to work. So what is the difference? But I think your point that you make is kind of an important point, which is, what are the regulations and standards of that country, and are the factories being held to those standards is a concern?
No, there's not. And like, my, obviously I was only there for once, but I've read a lot about, you know, what it's like, what happens in China, but seeing it firsthand, it was a way of like, wow, this is like looking at the Eastern Seaboard in 1910. It was like seeing America after the Gilded Age and into the, you know, Industrial Revolution. You were seeing things that were, it was unbelievable, you know, right. Just, and
so, unbelievably irresponsible?
No, just, it's that part of their history, or their you know, story arc as a nation is just where we were. They're an emerging nation. It's like, I don't sit in judgment. I just went and I saw it. And it was pretty amazing to see how rudimentary it was. But as a historian, all it did was remind me of what America would have been like during, like, New York sweatshops in 1910 or 1920, when child labor but when you talk about, like, these women working there and then moving on 3 months, why are they moving on? Like, a lot of times there's stories of where people come in and they get trained and they are skilled workers, but they learn something and they get headhunted. They go to another place, right, that hires them at a better wage, or maybe they're sick of, they want to go home. They want to be closer to home. If it's, maybe they get sensitive to epoxy and they have to be rotated into something else or go do something else. But I found that they were, you know, I was impressed with how hardworking and how dedicated and how skilled they actually were. But that said, I went through the factory we were using and did a workstation by workstation, you know, talk and you know, kind of an assay on everything. And it was astonishing, because we here in California or Hawaii or France or Australia, we have a certain baseline of, like, a surfboard industry, it's all there. So we kind of all know, like, roughly how surfboards are built, but they didn't. And what was interesting is we had at this factory that made our stand-up boards, we had the workforce to get together for a meet and greet, and there was like a question and answer, and one of the workers raised his hand and through an interpreter asked my partner Todd Bradley, like, how long do you like big nose foreign devils use these things, you know? And Todd goes, well, you know, a good, well-made surfboard can last, you know, 30, 40 years. And they all just started laughing. And he just turned to the interpreter, like, what? And he goes, oh, they thought that you just, you know, you wealthy Americans just use these things a couple times and throw them away. So that gets to this point of, like, with Greg Martz talking about how important it is for people that work on surfboards, especially in glassing, to surf and understand. Like, they had no idea what these things were for. I mean, some of the people there did, but... So what I did in some of the stages that I saw that were going wrong, especially sanding and all these other things, at every step of the way there was things that needed to be done, but I had them find a broken board and then cut a cross section out of it so that you could see a slice of the foam core and the, like, what you see in trade shows, people showing how their boards are built. And I just went and showed them, like, this is the margins you guys are working with. This is what we do. This is the forces that are put on it. And they're just building these things. They don't know. Yeah. There was guys in there that were shaping a couple big 12, 14 foot race boards, start to finish, out of EPS using a hot wire and planers that weren't even, you know, that I wouldn't even use on a door here. And they're doing those all day, you know, wearing bathroom slippers, you know, and they weigh like 100 pounds and everything. I mean, it's definitely a different, but that's why those are done there. We could do that here. And I think we will eventually. I think that, at some point, the law of diminishing returns is going to see that with the cost of shipping and political things and some of the QC issues that you start to see over there when they lose that skilled workforce and they go off into other things, is it'll end up being cheaper and better just to make them here. You go to a business-friendly county or state here, and, right, and you set up, you bring the expertise and you start making those boards here. Because for a lot of types of surfboards, it's a good way to build boards.
Right.
So, but what I take issue to is that people that point fingers at pop-outs, not understanding that there really aren't any pop-outs, are pointing fingers at that. And you have people here that are masquerading as hand shapers, groovy backyard shapers, but they're not. They're just doing, you know, they're just doing everything off of a computer.
Right.
But they're trying to masquerade as, you know, the real thing.
So we should probably give backstory on C4 Watermans, because you've referenced it.
Yeah.
What was it? What was your objective at the time?
Well, people had always been doing stand-up paddling in Hawaii for a long time. The Achoy brothers and a lot of the Beach Boys in Waikiki, people going back even, you know, to the 40s. You know, the Beach Boys used to go out on their oversized tandem boards with an oversized, like, canoe paddle and be able to paddle out with a camera around their neck and a cigarette behind their ear and take pictures of the tourists without getting wet. But so people had always done it. Laird Hamilton and Dave Kalama were doing it on tandem boards on Maui, you know, in the early to mid-90s. But Laird Hamilton had told my partner, Brian Keolana, about how good it was as a fitness exercise for tow surfing and foil boarding. And so Brian got a paddle, and this is 2002, and within 6 months, he turned it into a sport. It had just been steady state, nothing had been done, and within 6 months, he was already down from 12'6" by 30 inch wide to 10 foot by 28 carbon paddles, doing everything that you see out there, guys doing stand-up. Brian invented that at Makaha. And he was the Johnny Appleseed of it, and I was just fortunate enough to be there to help start building those boards. And then the racing and the open ocean stuff was 100%. That came entirely from us. That was a vision that Brian and Todd had to form a regatta class thing of downwind open ocean racing in Hawaii that would take its place alongside outrigger canoe and prone paddle boards.
You said earlier you couldn't get anybody to build those boards for you.
We were trying to build these things. It was right at the tail end of Clark Foam being in business. So, no one wanted to. People, you'd take these big boards, 10, 11 feet to go, especially some of them when they're EPS, to go get them glassed somewhere, and everybody just, no way, we don't want to touch that.
So you were shaping them?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
and you couldn't find anybody to glass them?
Couldn't find anybody to glass them.
Got it.
So another guy I was making boards for, Blaine Chambers, got impatient waiting, and he started kind of doing his own boards and found a network of people that would glass him, and I kind of threw in with him and started doing boards for him. That was Paddle Surf Hawaii. And so Paddle Surf Hawaii and C4, we were the first people actually making boards. And we originally, Blaine Chambers and I, wanted just to do it in Hawaii. We didn't want to go the China route like everybody else. And but at some point, the sport caught on, and if we didn't do the boards like everybody else, we would have just been left behind, you know?
So you find yourself in China, and ultimately the boards were being manufactured in China.
Yeah.
You're talking
that
about...
That was some years later, though. But, you know, everybody changed their mind. After the 2008 slump or recession or depression or whatever you call it, the surf industry took a dump, and stand-up was just right there waiting.
Sure.
It basically saved the industry. You know, it did.
By having to go through a belt tightening and...
There all of a sudden, right when there was a reduced demand for surfboards and wetsuits and rash guards and graphics and everything, all of a sudden stand-up came in and it just blew it open. Board covers, wetsuits, paddle, everything. All of a sudden there was this whole new sport that people want, and you could do it anywhere. So it totally patched over what would have been a huge downturn for the surf industry.
Got it.
Hard and soft goods, you know.
You were talking about having those meetings with the laborers in the factory and kind of trying to illustrate to them details about the actual use of the equipment. Do you feel like you were able to successfully convey that to them to where they could then be better at their job?
Well, what we do is just go through, we would give them a detailed instruction on for each workstation and what to do step by step, and get them some video. There's videos of like glassing and shaping, you know, an EPS and epoxy so that they could see. But ultimately at that point, I just felt like, you know, we're not in the business of teaching them how to make composite structures. They should be, you know, doing it, you know, right. And that was kind of late when our company was already facing a lot of challenges. We spent almost all our resources on innovation and marketing and blazing the trails, and then a lot of other people just came in and just went, well, thanks guys, you laid the track, here's our locomotive, you know.
Right.
And that's kind of what happened.
Yeah. I'm just curious if with even US-based manufacturers, US-based surfboard brands that are outsourcing labor, is there a way for them to, educate those laborers in those countries to build the quality of boards that we're building here in the US?
Well, they can build quality. Some of the factories are really good. I'm just talking about some of the ones that I've seen, but the Cobra factory in Thailand, they build very good stuff. You know, that's a
different construction. That is that.
No, these guys, they were doing this similar things. They were instead of the Davinicil Center, like on our boards, there was bamboo veneer, and it was still done in a molded, like under a tremendous, these molds were like 500 pounds each lid. Everything's done under pressure. They're not quite as elaborate as those, as the SurfTech Cobra type thing, but that's, you know, I would consider that the gold standard for that. But that can be done here. It's what I'm saying is that it's done because it's all that, it's, there's cheap labor and no regulations.
We just reference everything as outsourced manufacturing, and then sometimes we'll throw the label on of Asian manufacturing. What countries are producing surfboards? What countries are manufacturing surfboards in Asia?
Well, I think most countries have some sort of a beachhead there, but see, I'm not talking about outsourcing. I'm if we're talking about protecting the domestic industry, I believe, like Gordon Clark did, that if the domestic builders here didn't overshape and use better materials and gave the customer a better, more durable product, we wouldn't have to worry about it. And I just take offense that when people say, you know, pop-outs, because I just don't see any pop-outs. There's no such thing as a pop-out over there. There's people working hard in emerging nations. And if you believe in that kind of globalism or global equality, then you just want to think, let them have a leg up, you know? Whether it should infiltrate surfboards, it's really up to the consumer by just not buying something that they, just based on price. And a lot of it, what we're trying to do is educate people that are ignorant of the materials and workmanship that go into it. I mean, it's a hot button thing for people about taking jobs away from here. I think we're in a really good position. I think that we're gaining ground on that. And yet, it's not to say that those boards are inferior. It's just what's inferior about it, I think, is that the surfboard industry was always a cottage industry for people that were actively involved or passionate about the sport. It was a way for them to stay close to the beach, which is harder and harder to do in California, and make a living from something that they love and be around people that they're familiar with and everything like that. And more and more, it's gone into, you know, a different, like, hypermarket kind of mindset. And then as surfing got into that everybody surfs boom, like in the 2003 through the crash of the housing thing, and everybody surfing was the new yoga, that was part of it. But now we're starting to see kind of a recession of that, and we're kind of coming back, and we're seeing, you know, incredible boutique shapers and glassers that are putting out incredible work, a lot of experimentation. It's kind of like the 70s again. So, I mean, I think there's room for it all, but it's what really needs to happen is the customer needs to be educated about how surfboards are made and what you are buying when you're buying something. And that, you know, if I had a quiver, I would, if I wanted a Donald Takayama, classic Donald Takayama 9-2, like high performance longboard, and he's not here to make me one anymore, I would be perfectly fine with getting one of those molded composite ones like that, having it as part of my quiver. But then I would have all my other boards and everything else. But it's all just about diversifying into that. I just don't want to demonize that kind of construction without people understanding it. It's really only there because you're taking advantage of a developing country that has none of the protections that we've come to know and take for granted here since basically like the New Deal.
You talked about Greg Martz. Part of his requirement when they're hiring a new employee is that they surf. How important is that for a laborer in the manufacturing process?
Well, I think he's speaking kind of tongue in cheek on that, but I don't really think it's. I think it's the culture. Like, if you bring in somebody into a glass shop like Waterman's Guild, and maybe they don't surf, but if they're around people that do surf and explain things, I think they can learn a particular aspect of the job and do it well. It's like surfing too. We all need to be indoctrinated by people that were here first, whether it's at a surf break or in the industry or just philosophy and about history of our sport. And I think that indoctrination process has broken down, and it has become by default set out to, you know, like the apparel companies and or companies that have high markups on what they do and with their hang tag stuff. Like that's kind of who's doing it. The magazines aren't really doing it anymore. And there's not, I don't really see a voice for our elders to indoctrinate people into it, into what value. So on that level, like in a shop, I think if you have a shop that is working and it's like a big family and there's a lot of knowledge in it, I think you can take somebody and adopt somebody that's not from the surfing culture or doesn't surf and teach them what you do. And they'd probably do a great job. I don't think it's an absolute necessity, but I think most people that own glass shops would say they didn't want surfers because they always quit when the waves are good.
I mean, there's certainly that. I don't think it's specific to surfing and the surf industry. If you have a chef who's passionate about food and wine and loves eating, I have a feeling his dish is going to come out better than the guy who has no passion for it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And no matter what the industry is, a guy who loves numbers, who's an accountant, is going to be better at balancing the books than somebody who's just...
Yeah, I think I remember once there was one of Rusty Priesendorfer's really most prized shapers that did some of his boards prior to the shaping machines a long time ago. It was a guy that didn't surf.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, he was fantastic. He just said the guy was the most accurate guy, showed up, worked all day, didn't complain. So I think it's good to have a passion, and it's important, but, you know, ideally the craft and the trade should be at that cottage industry level, I think.
Yeah.
I think that's where it finds its best equilibrium, and I think people are happier. I don't think people that would go to a giant consortium that's owned by a parent company that maybe bought a surf label and just works in there laying up 30 shortboards or scraping the ridges off 30 blanks a day is going to be as happy as, you know, all of us really lucky bespoke shapers that get to make boards for people and deal with them. It's a blessing for me. I've just met so many cool people really opening up the doors to customers in the last 5 years.
Yeah. I think that's been infused through almost all the conversations I've had with surfboard shapers, that it's like the personal relationship with the shaper, and especially if you're ordering multiple boards from them over and over and kind of refining that relationship, is where the value is at. And it ends up translating in how the board performs as well. But I mean, I've had, you know, those kind of large mass produced model made boards from Asia. I've ridden a few of them. They work fine, but they've never been the best boards I've had, and they've never been the worst boards I've had either.
Yeah.
You know, they're just kind of like, they're reliable and they surf, but they're not, there's never the element of magic in them either.
Yeah. Everything works. Everything. In fact, that's what I tell people that are shaping their first 10 boards and they're so stage struck about it. And I said, those will be probably more likely to hit upon something accidentally or otherwise that is a really cool new design wrinkle than somebody that has shaped 10,000 boards and they're just sterile.
Right.
They're just too good. So I always like looking at funky boards that people, surfer shapers do or backyard shapers do, because you never know when you're just going to hit something interesting.
Right.
But that relationship is important, I think. I think that's really why we all surf.
I think so.
To have those, whether it's in the water or talking about boards, and, you know, not to put too fine a point on it and politicize surfboards and make it too serious, because they're all just for having fun. They're all just these little boomerangs that we're carving and throwing and coming back and, hey, Bill made one that does this. Let's try to improve on that. I mean, that's all it is. But at the same time, people are spending a lot of hard-earned money on things, so I just think it's important that they're educated on what goes into boards, because there's so many myths about it.
There's myths, and I'll be honest, there's been what I view as intentional kind of misdirection by a lot of brands.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's more or less a construction thing, although it can be, but it's another issue, I think, of, you know, how we address something like that. Because, on one hand, you could say, well, it's the consumer's fault if they fall for it because they're not educated. And the other hand, it's like, you could say, well, who's really hurt, you know? I mean, I guess the one thing you could say is that what we'd like is to have more people in the trade, more people learning it. And it's nice to see when you see some of these glass shops, because that's the main thing about having all these people making surfboards here, is it's putting people in learning trades. There's kids that are learning how to sand and polish and, you know, laminate and everything. And that was kind of disappearing for a while.
Yeah. What do we have on the horizon? Is there anything in the future in terms of construction materials, technique?
People always ask about, well, when I say there's nothing new under the sun, and they say, well, no, come on, it can't be that way. And I'm, well, you know, materials can get, we can get better materials, or materials that used to be too exotic or too expensive can start to get more generic and more cheaply made, and we can get those. So materials, but design-wise, nothing's really going to change. It's just going to be the dictates of function and fashion and where people want to go on waves and what waves they want to ride. But material-wise, it's hard to say. I mean, I do think about things like trends in surfboard manufacture, like 3D printers, or that, and, you know, how that might integrate with automation and CNC machines. I mean, wouldn't it be possible to build something like a scale model, like a 1/10th model of something, and then just have it scanned and it's, or even chopped up into little like slices and sent overseas, or of course you don't even need to do that, like digitally. It just seems like surfboard design is in danger of going further and further away from just cut and try in the shaping room and more into that. Once it gets to a certain tipping point where it's just so easy and everything just integrates with different machines. And, you know, so where do all these guys that are just getting into it now and excited about making their own boards and trying all these, you know, cool new things, where do they fit into that? And to have all those glass shops like the Waterman's Guilds and other, you know, great glass shops with all that expertise, it's kind of like the submarine manufacturers of the Apollo project. If you don't keep them going, that expertise runs out and you can't just start it up again.
No.
So luckily we've been able to keep it alive. But what happens when it doesn't?
Right.
Then it probably just goes to guys looking through old books and the internet, just figuring out how to do cut laps and how to mix pigments, and people doing it in their backyards, which is fine. But I feel good about the domestic industry.
Good.
You know, I look at the example of Japan, the way they were in the surfing craze, especially in the 80s. You know, highly civilized country, very technology minded, into convenience, all their things. But when it comes to some things, they revere craftsmanship. They revere that closeness to nature. I mean, they could mass produce glass floats or plastic floats for fishing nets, but there's still a lot of people that do the traditional kind, and those are highly valued, and they have their own maker's marks on it and everything. So I think that a lot of things in America, we've gone that way, where we're starting to get more appreciative of craftsmanship and things that are built, you know, small brew type of things. And so it's so much better than I would have predicted 20 years ago or 10 years ago. I couldn't even have imagined being in this place right now where we're seeing all the things we're doing, and so many young shapers just doing everything on without getting sucked into giant, you know, big label concerns that are just out to just suck them up and make them work in anonymity.
Right. Last time we met here at Libertine, you were talking about experimenting with foil boards. Any developments on that front?
No, I haven't had time to do it much. My friends in Hawaii, or everybody seems to be getting into like off the stand-up platform for launching the, you know, getting the foil. And everybody's just riding shorter boards. I mean, some of the kids are riding super, super short boards, like below 4 feet even. And I think the rationale behind that is that you want to feel like you're surfing or flying the foil rather than a board. And then this big board, and somewhere under there is a foil. And but you've seen some pretty amazing stuff. I mean, guys are doing incredible surfing on it. So
I mean, there really isn't a need for the board, right? Other than just,
well, you have to stand on something, and if you're not getting towed in, then you have to have some sort of a
paddling.
Yeah, you have to have some sort of a launch ramp, and the board is catching the wave.
Yeah,
but
once you're up and riding, there's no need for excess, right?
No, it's a detriment, because what you want is more sensitivity with feeling that foil, because at that point you're really just standing on a model airplane upside down. It's an oversized model airplane, and it's doing the same things.
Right.
That's what's cool about it. It's a lot like flying.
Yeah.
But, you know, once again, like a lot of things, like tow-in surfing, even like stand-up surfing, ideally it spreads people out. Right. And I'm sure there'll be guys taking foil boards out in crowded breaks, just like longboards and stand-up boards, and they'll probably hurt people, but most people are probably going to just spread out into unused territory.
Right.
But how we're going to build those boards, that's an exciting time. I do think that sometimes like some of the 3D printing things, if that gets to be, somebody might just happen upon that thing that I was telling you about, like with Gordon Clark accidentally discovering something that might put us all out of work, you know?
The 3D printing thing is really interesting because you can do one-offs with that.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't need to put a ton of R&D into a model,
right,
and manufacturing and blah, blah, blah. No, you just do one-off.
Yeah, and that's what's interesting, because anything that gets you closer to changing design and altering design swell to swell is kind of where you want to go. But it's exciting time. I think people are still going to, when you think about it, it's amazing. And in this day and age, with all the assaults on tradition, with, you know, the internet, social media, and everything else, that there's still people that can order a raw foam blank from a company in Southern California and get it shipped up analog in a truck, and then they go out and shape it to a custom order sheet, and it's hand glassed and hand sanded and hand polished. And golf clubs and snowboards aren't made like that. It's tennis rackets aren't made like that. Skis aren't made. It's pretty amazing that it's still there. And maybe it says something about surfers' desire for to be unique after all.
A stick, a stone. It's the end of the road. It's feeling alone. It's the weight of your load. It's a sliver of glass. It's life, it's the sun. It's night, it's death. It's a knife, it's a gun. A flower that blooms. A fox in the brush. A nut in the wood. The song of a thrush. The mystery of life. The steps in the hall. The sound of the wind and the waterfall. It's the moon floating free. It's the curve of the slope. It's an ant, it's a bee, it's a reason for hope. And the riverbank sings of the waters of March. It's the promise of spring, it's the joy in your heart.
And that concludes On Boards with Dave Parmenter, Doug Fletcher of the Santa Cruz Board Builders Guild, and Ryan Martz of the Watermen's Guild. Thank you to Channel Islands for donating the Rocket Wide built-in spine tech to support this series. Thank you to you, the listeners, for supporting in the form of financial donations and sharing this show with friends. You can find images and links to everything that we discussed in this series on SurfSplendorPodcast.com. You can also find our entire archive of shows, 3 previous interviews with Dave Parmenter prior to this series, interviews with other board builders like Mickey Munoz, Eric Arakawa, Tom Parrish, John Pizel, as well as other surf luminaries like Aaron Chang, Todd Glazer, Jamie Brissick, Matt Warshaw, Steve Pesman. It is all available for free. I am so done talking about board building. I'm recording this final send-off from Maui, so you could probably hear the wind in the trees and animals in the background of my intro and outro for this episode. I am headed off to the beach to go surfing repeatedly, but I'll record a couple of shows while I'm here. I'll publish something for you next week. Until then, get back into the ocean, share some waves, and shred on. Resto de toco, é pouco sozinho, é cobra e pão, é João e José, é espinho na mão, é corte no pé, são as águas de março fechando o verão, e a promessa de vida no teu coração. A stick, a stone, it's the end of the road, the stump of a tree, it's a frog, it's a toad, a sigh, a breath, a walk, a run, a life, a death.
the rain, the sun, and the riverbank sings of the waters of March. It's the promise of life, it's the joy in your heart. São as águas de março fechando o verão e a promessa de vida no teu coração. É pau, é pedra, é o fim do caminho. É resto de toco, é pouco sozinho. É pau, é pedra, é o fim do caminho. Resto de toco, pouco sozinho. Pão, pedra, fim do caminho. Resto de toco.